House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Thursday, March 12th. Open a public hearing. I'm sorry. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2660.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2660 comes to us from Representative Olson and Senator Brzozinski. The bill allows court discretion in ordering an ignition interlock device in driving under the influence of intoxicants diversion cases if the defendant submitted to a chemical test of their breath or blood and the result is less than 0.10% by weight. The bill additionally provides an exemption from the ignition interlock device requirement if the result of the test is 0.00 by weight. And lastly, the bill reorganizes fee and license suspension portions of the law. We have dash one amendments before us today. The amendments state that the ignition interlock devices will be required where a chemical test of the breath or blood results in a 0.08% by weight or greater, or in any case where a combination of controlled substances and alcohol is present. The amendments provide for court discretion in ordering an ignition interlock device in cases with a result of less than a 0.08% by weight where no controlled substances are present. And we're still waiting on the paperwork for the dash one amendments.
Representative Olson.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name's Andy Olson. I'm state representative from the Albany area, and good afternoon. This bill, House Bill 2660, is kind of a continuation from a bill 2 years ago that this committee has heard and dealt with, the ignition interlock device. One of the areas that we've had some concern with when the bill was first introduced and passed a few years back dealt with the folks that, well, weren't under the influence of alcohol, which is what the ignition interlock device is designed to measure, but were, you know, convicted for being under the influence of some type of a substance, marijuana or some other thing. Now, before going any further, I want to say that I do believe in the ignition interlock device, and I'll just call it the IID. And I think it is a great tool. But at the same time, I don't want to be in a position to carve it out in the way the law is written right now that it would be designed to be used. But I do want to return some discretion back to the courts for the area that I'll explain to you here a little bit, specifically what the dash one amendments do. So what the dash one amendments do is it gives discretion to the court to place a subject who's been convicted or goes through the diversion program for driving under the influence of intoxicants only under two different circumstances. One is if the blood alcohol level that they had at the time of the arrest was zero or under a 0.08 blood alcohol, or if they were found to be at a 0.00 level of no alcohol on board, but of a controlled substance. Those are the only two instances. So if you have a combination of both alcohol, and let's say, for example, you might have somebody that's been smoking a couple joints of marijuana. I guess we should be calling it cigarettes now here in the near future. But that they're under the influence of a combination of marijuana and some alcohol, and they're clearly under an 0.08, well, the courts do not have the latitude then to give that discretion for IID, that, in fact, that type of a situation would elevate that individual to having to have an IID for the next year. The other circumstances would be that if they refuse to take a breath test, that stays the same, and then also if they blow a 0.08 blood alcohol or higher. So that's really what this is all about. It's not that we're taking away or doing anything different other than just giving some discretion in different circumstances on the lower end of the whole spectrum. And I have with me Josette Hugo. She's Chief of Staff for Representative Debbie Boone, and you're going to share a story.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask?
Yes.
Just a very brief question. As I remember correctly, the interlock only works for alcohol. It won't work for marijuana in that case. Is that right?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlich, that's right.
Thank you.
My name is Josette Hugo, and my permanent address is in Scappoose, Oregon. And like Representative Olson said, I'm You know me as a staffer here, but I'm here before you today as a mother and in behalf of my daughter, who to whom this bill hopefully would have some, she would like to testify in favor of this bill, but she couldn't come because she's couldn't get off work. So her name is Adrienne Cranberg, and she resides in Scappoose, Oregon as well. And these are her words. For the past 4 years, I have been on medication for chronic depression disorder and acute social anxiety disorder. I have been under the care of Holly Balzbaugh at OHSU Scappoose, Oregon Clinic. I take Effexor every day and lorazepam as needed for anxiety attacks. On the evening of October 20th, 2014, I had an acute anxiety attack. These are rare, and I have only used the lorazepam twice before in the previous few years. The dosing information states to take 1/2 to 1 tablet every 4 hours as needed for symptoms. I took one tablet at about 6 p.m. Having no relief after 3 hours, I took another tablet and fell asleep on my couch. The next thing I was aware of, I was driving in St. Helens, 7 miles from my home. I was wearing a t-shirt, running shorts, and socks. I had no purse on me, only a wallet. I thought I needed to go pick up my middle daughter and her husband at a local bar. I don't know where this thought came from. I hadn't spoken with my daughter all day. However, I did go to the tavern, stumbled in, and asked if she was there. I was told no, and I left. Apparently, I was walking around outside my car for some time because a neighbor saw me, called the police, and indicated that I didn't seem to know where I was. I got in the car and, according to the police, was driving 10 miles per hour toward my father's house 3 blocks away. I was taken to the police department where I was administered a breathalyzer which read 0.0. I had no alcohol in my system. I again stated what I had taken and that I wasn't aware of much regarding how and why I got where I was at the time. I asked if I was going to go to the hospital. They said no, I was being booked into custody and charged with a DUII. My mother posted bail and I left a few hours later. On January 15th, I appeared in court for the first time. I was assigned a court-appointed attorney and told to return in 30 days. After consulting with my attorney on the phone for 15 minutes, it was made clear to me that proving state of mind and or giving an explanation as to how I came to be in this position would be an exercise in futility. It was recommended that I ask to enter the diversion program as I'd never been in trouble before. I returned to court and was able to explain to the judge what had happened. I provided her with documentation from my doctor and a printout from Walmart Pharmacy in order to show her that I was taking prescription medication legally and as intended. She felt for me and said that, unfortunately, there were certain stipulations that had to be imposed regardless of the reason I stood before her. I was ordered to pay court fees totaling $550, told to attend a victim's impact panel, to submit to a drug and alcohol assessment, and to have a breathalyzer installed into my car by February 13, 2015. When I asked about the device, I was told it was to detect blood alcohol content. I told her I didn't drink, that it was prescription medication I'd had an adverse reaction to. She said that it was out of her hands. This leads me here today by proxy, as I am unable to attend due to work commitments. I would like to ask that 2660 be passed and entered into law. To ask people with no alcohol infraction to have to pay for, be monitored once a month, and be subject to the imposition of operating a BAC device serves no useful purpose. If a person is found to have violated the law by drinking and driving, I think that this device is a great tool that should be used. However, for those people whose infraction was not alcohol-related, it does no good for them or the state to have to utilize it. Having to carry, plug in, wait for 3 minutes warm-up time and periodic rolling tests every 25 minutes while driving in order to see if I've been drinking serves no useful purpose, and in fact feels as though I'm being punished every day for a crime that I did not commit. It causes me to experience such anxiety that I have begun walking to work just to avoid using my car. I feel humiliated in front of my children and grandchildren, and I'm terrified that someone I know will see me, as this is a small town. This bill will not affect my circumstances. However, I am concerned about others who may continue to be affected by current law. Please vote in favor of House Bill 2660 so that each situation can be assessed on its own merits by the court. The individual given the best possible treatment options and the use of the auto breathalyzer be used only in alcohol-involved driving offenses. To do otherwise ensnares many people unnecessarily in a net when a hook would suffice to catch the intended offenders. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify in favor of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Hugo. Is there any question? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Teresa Douglas, Jody Vaughn, and Kate Duke. You go in any order, but please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Jody would like to go first.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Jody Vaughn. I am the Vice Chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. I'm here on behalf of the committee to oppose 2660, including the Dash 1 amendments. A little bit about my background. I've been working as a prosecutor since 1987, and I've carried a caseload involving DUIs and vehicular manslaughters and assaults during that entire time because that's the caseload that I prefer. In regard to two parts of the bill, the first part of the bill that I want to address is the judicial discretion for 0.08 or below 0.08 for judges to order the intoxilizer. I want to give the committee some examples why that is an arbitrary number and why it's really not fair to everyone that's involved. First off, the reason a person is convicted for DUI is because a judge has either found them guilty, a jury has found them guilty, or they've admitted their guilt. And what the legal definition of under the influence is that a person's physical or mental faculties are adversely affected to a noticeable or perceptible degree by the use of intoxicating liquor. It's not about the number, it's about impairment. There are a number of ways that impaired drivers can come into the district attorney's office with a BAC of below a 0.08. Right now I work in Klamath County, which is a large county. Our North County intoxilizer site would be in Deschutes County, and the closest intoxilizer that we would have is at the Klamath County Jail. Sometimes people come into that are arrested after they've been in a patrol car for an hour and a half, and their blood alcohol content will be below a 0.08. In the month of February, I prosecuted a woman who was a 0.07. It took 45 minutes to get her to the jail, so it took about an hour and a half to process her. She was driving in front of a patrol car. The officer actually had his video camera on and watched her as she drove over a sidewalk and through a fence, thinking that she was at an intersection. When she came to the Klamath County Jail, her blood alcohol was a 0.07. That case was tried before a jury, and a jury did convict. But under this law, the judge would have the discretion whether or not it should be ordered. And I would say to you that if the intoxilizer had been closer, then probably it would have been above a 0.08, and therefore there would be no discretion available. The other times where I see low intoxilizer results involving crashes is when defendants have been injured and have been transported to the hospital for medical treatment. They're provided fluids just as a matter of medical treatment, and that does dilute the amount of blood alcohol in the system. And so when we do get the blood test results, it could be below a 0.08. We have to work with the crime lab and hospital records to determine how much saline solution they got so we can backstrap. If it was arbitrary below a 0.08 or discretionary below 0.08, if we wanted to get an intoxilizer ignition interlock put on the vehicle for the defendant, we'd have to bring those witnesses into to the court at sentencing in order to argue our position, and that is a lot of energy and wasted effort. The other thing is that some people are affected by lesser amounts of alcohol, and they don't need to drink a whole bunch before they start feeling the effects. And so some people are always going to have a low blow. So they could have a diversion that's below 0.08. They can get convicted and be below 0.08. If you leave it to the judiciary, then it's going to be different in different courtrooms. Every judge is different. Every judge has different judicial philosophies. And I would submit to you that it would seem to be a bit unfair if one judge doesn't impose it and another judge does impose it. So those are the reasons why the GAC is objecting to that. And the other thing I wanted to point out is, according to the statistics that we have, there was about 18,000 diversions that have been entered, and only about 6,000 intoxilizers have been ordered, IIDs have been ordered for those 18,000 diversions. So the judges are not really following the law at this point. I had a meeting with one of the judges I work with, and he was not even clear about it being mandatory for diversions to impose ignition interlock. And this is after the bill's been in effect for quite some time. And I say that only because judges are just like the rest of us. They have different things that are important to them. Some of them like criminal law, some of them like civil law. And the ones who are doing civil law really don't pay that much attention sometimes to what's going on in the criminal arena. The second part is about the .00 not being allowed to order the intoxilizer at all. The position of the Governor's Advisory Committee is that most of the time people who are driving under the influence are polydrug users, and I'll leave it to my learned colleagues that know more about this than I do. We're concerned that if they are required to use an intoxilizer, they'll just shift their drug of choice from the controlled substance they were using to alcohol, and if they don't have the IID on their car, then obviously they can still drive while impaired. And the bottom line, the most important part of all this, and what's important to me, is that people who are victimized by impaired drivers, they're often the most shocked people to be in the criminal justice system because they haven't done anything wrong. And so they're driving down the road, and all of a sudden they're hit by somebody, their family members are killed, they're injured, they're maimed. And they just don't think it's fair, and they don't understand why. And they especially don't understand why someone who's got a prior conviction or a prior diversion is still out there driving and in a position to hurt them. And so I would urge you to remember the victims of these crimes who haven't done anything at all. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Teresa Douglas. I'm the director of Pioneer Alcohol and Drug Evaluation Services in Oregon City. I've been an alcohol and drug evaluation specialist for the last 30 years. I'm also a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI. And I'm here to speak to you on House Bill 2660. As an evaluator, I can tell you that people do not usually stick to just one substance. And when they go into treatment and they're being urine tested as part of their treatment, they're not just tested for alcohol. They're tested for alcohol and all different kinds of drugs. And you would be surprised at some of the people that come back with positive urine tests. Part of the diversion program, since this started in 1982, has been the requirement that they not operate a vehicle with any intoxicant in their body during the year that they're on diversion. We have not had a way to monitor that other than urine testing while they're in treatment. And they're not in treatment for the entire year. It's generally around 4 to 6 months, and then they're on their own, and we have no way to monitor them. I will also agree with Jody, because a lot of times there is a time lapse between the time these people are actually stopped and the time they get in to take the breath test. And many times I have seen people at an 08 or under that are actually really alcoholic. Once you start talking to them and getting a history, they have a long history of alcohol abuse or alcoholism, but the circumstances were such that they were caught at under 0.08. Also, impairment is impairment, whether it comes from alcohol or prescription medications or illegal drugs. And that is the statute, is driving under the influence of intoxicants. A lot of these folks, once they know that that's what they've been caught for and that's what they're supposedly going to be tested for, they will switch to something else. I have a lot of people that they get their DUI on alcohol. They may get this random urine test at the program and come up positive for oxycodone. And it wasn't even their pill. It was somebody that gave them the pill because they had a headache. So, you know, if we're really serious about public safety and about keeping people from reoffending, then the interlock has become a really important tool for us to not only monitor their compliance with diversion, but also to deal with them as far as treatment concerns. I have several times where they've been out of treatment already. They've blown a positive on their interlock device. That has then triggered my investigation into what they're doing, send them back to court. They come back to me, and I'm able to send them back to treatment. Obviously, they missed something when they were in treatment. So it's been a great tool for myself and for the treatment programs to really address what their issues are with alcohol and hopefully make some positive changes in their lives. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions, and I would ask that this bill be opposed. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Sorry, I forgot to give these to her.
Thank you, Chair Barker, and members of the committee for allowing me to speak today. My name is Kate Duke. I'm a board member of the Mad Lane County chapter. And I am here today on behalf of MAD. MAD strongly opposes House Bill 2660. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, requiring interlocks for all drunk drivers saves lives. These statistics are out there. The research is out there. It's pretty much proven that this is working. According to the CDC, requiring interlocks for all drunk drivers actually reduces recidivism by 67%. License suspension alone is not an effective tool. 50 to 75% of drunk drivers continue to drive on a suspended license, and that allows them to be out on our roads where they may crash into somebody else, cause injuries, or kill somebody. While they're continuing to drive. There are currently 24 states that have laws requiring interlocks for all drunk drivers. Passing House Bill 2660 would move Oregon backwards in the effort to combat impaired driving. So again, Mothers Against Drunk Driving strongly urges you to protect Oregon families and oppose House Bill 2660. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
Yeah, I have a question, okay. Mr. Chair.
Me too, Mrs.
Okay. So, any of you ladies, thank you. What would you do in response to this then that you heard in testimony earlier about this gal, this daughter that doesn't drink? And I mean, I guess actually you would probably be a good one to talk about it.
Well, there's always, Mr. Chair, committee, Representative Olson, there's always exceptions to every rule. And I have seen a lot of people that have gotten their DUIs on medication, but it's very rare to find someone that's on medication that doesn't also drink alcohol. So I think, you know, if you're going to make the exception for one versus all of the other people that are possibly driving with that intoxicant in their body, you have to weigh the risk for that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Greenlick.
I'm not sure who I need to ask this question to, but perhaps I could try. Your vice
it's
chair.
Your birthday. Go ahead.
Thank it is you. Your birthday.
Happy
birthday. Yes. We get into a lot of trouble with shall not, may and may not. And the third condition under which describes this, I think it's in the second page on line.
You're looking at the bill instead of the amendment?
Will the amendment replace the bill? I am looking at the bill. I'm sorry.
Yes.
There's a thing about a judge may not. Is that cleared up in the amendment? It says that the court may not require that an approved ignition interface be used. By that, does that mean that he is or she is not allowed to do it?
By the term of may, it's permissive.
May is permissive in the one above. Right. It says the judge may. This one says the judge may not.
Okay.
Which sounds to me like...
Well, it's stronger in the amendment, Representative Greenlick, because what it says is the court shall require, and it identifies 0.08 or higher, refusal of breath test, or the combination that I described. And then the second portion of it would be, for the discretionary part, would be may require.
And what about the third? Is there a C in that?
The C part is also the part that would be if there was found to be no alcohol at all, but it was some type of
but
a...
does that say may not? I thought that...
May not.
In that case, I mean, he's not allowed to, or she is not allowed to use an innervate, rather than, I thought we were saying the judge had discretion in that case. We may need...
Not in the case of, in a case of a .000, the judge would not have discretion.
The judge would not be allowed to. So the notion of judicial discretion, I think we may want to clarify that if that's not what's...
That's a good point. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Leininger.
Thank you. And thank you for your service on the Governor's Alcohol and Drug, or the DUI Commission. I served on the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission for the Governor before, and I'm a mother also, and I care very much about having our roads be safe and free of impaired drivers. But I'm concerned because a lot of the good information that you provided is information that assumes in every instance in which a judge has discretion to look at the facts and circumstances, the judge would always decide against an intoxilizer. But I felt like a lot of what you were saying is that there are some circumstances where a person would be below that threshold when a judge reasonably would require it. So I guess I think, you know, I think we have to also trust the judges will, when they have discretion to make a wise choice as opposed to a silly choice, will make a wise choice. I mean, our whole criminal justice system is based on the notion that judges are empowered to analyze situations and make wise choices, and they're elected too. And if they make silly choices, then they can be recalled. But I, as an attorney and someone who's worked for a couple of different federal judges, I have to say that I find this set of facts really compelling. And I think the notion that this person whose testimony was read by her mother, the idea that she's got an intoxilizer on her car clearly does not match the problem that she was struggling with. And I just don't feel comfortable with the notion that we need to scrap all judicial discretion. And you're not suggesting we scrap all of it, but it seems to be one of those situations where I'm not I like the bill. You know, maybe we need to clarify it, but I think that it does some things that are important, and I share your concern about the issue, but I'm not sure that an intoxilizer without discretion is always the right answer.
May I respond?
Yes, please.
Chair Barker, with all due respect, I know you've been in the federal court system, and I've been in the state court system my entire career, and the two systems are incredibly different. We will have an afternoon session where we will have probably 75 files where our courtrooms will be packed from the front of the courtroom all the way out to the hallway with defendants. And you're asking a judge to make a decision about whether or not someone should have an ignition interlock on their car when they have about 60 seconds to evaluate what the evidence is. The state justice system is breaking underneath the weight of all the decisions that the judges have to make. And if you haven't had a chance to go to a court, a state court, and watch one of the, I call them a cattle call session, but it's really true. It's really quite eye-opening. My brother practices in federal court, and he went to state court with me one time and was just shocked and amazed at the kind of work that I do as a prosecutor in the state system. The other thing I wanted to say was this bill, it allows a judge to make it, it's discretionary as to whether or not, if it's below a .08 with some alcohol and a controlled substance. And that basically means that anybody who drives under a .08 with a non-controlled substance, such as Topamax. Topamax is a drug, it's not controlled. It's being prescribed quite a bit lately for migraine headaches, I understand. And people are coming into the courtroom who are highly impaired by this Topamax and drinking alcohol at the same time. That person would not have an ignition interlock on their car, even though they were highly impaired. The reason I bring this up is one of the people that work in my office was prescribed this drug, and she was obviously impaired when she showed up at work. And this was, again, prescribed by her doctor. So the question becomes, is it more important to protect the community or to protect the one individual? I would suggest to you, and I know that I've been doing this a long time, but I tend not to believe every single story I hear. I'm not sure that they're all untrue, but a lot of them, when we put them to the test on a polygraph, they simply don't pass. So, you know, I understand why that story is very compelling, but I'm not sure that, and I've heard stories like that before. I'm just not sure they're true.
Sure, I'd like to follow up on that. I think I heard you say that because the state courts are busy rather than the leisurely pace of the federal court, judges don't have the time to make any decisions?
The state court judges
they have no time for judgment? Is that your point?
No, my point is that they are very, it's a high pressured situation. It's much different than federal court. Federal court, they might set one or two defendants on the docket.
But are you saying that they're too busy to use their discretion? Is that, I heard that very clearly. I suppose the prosecutors who have lots of time to make discussion.
No, we don't either. We don't either. But what I'm trying to tell you is that because the system is the way it is, that if we have a defendant who is below a .08, and if we want to tell the judge that they got three prior Dewey convictions and we want to research whether or not they were below .08, that's going to take a lot of time, when the reality is this person has already made poor choices involving alcohol and has continued to drive. And that's the concern.
Well, except if the prosecutor had done their job, they would have had that information for the judge, right?
I would invite you to come down to Klamath County and spend a day
with me. I've been in courts before.
Well, I'm just trying to tell you, I start work at 7. Sometimes I don't leave till 8. And I work as hard as I can every day to do the right thing. And I cannot do all the work that is possibly required of a prosecutor. And I work a lot of weekends, too. Because not only am I doing the DUIs, but I'm also doing all the rape cases. I'm doing child abuse. I'm doing homicides, attempted assaults. So the system is very, very pressed. And I'm not saying the judges don't have the discretion or they don't have the mindset. I'm just saying that we don't have time to fully inform the judges, nor do they have time to really listen when you have defendants.
Well, why don't we just lock up everybody that's charged? And we don't have to worry about the judge making any decision. We don't have to take time for cases and things.
We're not talking about locking people up. We're talking about public safety, about making sure that the roads are safe by people who have made poor choices about alcohol use and driving a vehicle. That's what I'm talking about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who's best to answer this question. One of the concerns I have about interlock devices, and I think they're a great device, and I think the way it's intended to be done is generally a good thing. But what is the mechanism to enforce it? Is there a mechanism? I confess, I have a friend. She has a problem. Multiple drunk driving. She was supposed to have an interlock device. I never saw it show up in her car. So we can talk a lot about who should and shouldn't. What's the enforcement mechanism to make sure those that we've already determined should are?
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer. There is actually some discretion on the part of the offender whether they get the interlock device. During diversion, they can choose not to drive, and if they choose not to drive, they don't have to install the machine. Convictions, they are required to have it for a one-year or a two-year time period, either during the time they have their suspension if they apply for hardship or after their suspension. Right now, as it stands, if they wait out that time and say that they're not driving, then they don't have to put the machine in.
Follow up,
please.
My question is, what's the mechanism to enforce it now? Because I understand that's some of the criteria, but I'm telling you, people don't follow it.
Right.
Can I answer that? That's one of the issues that has is being addressed in the Senate. We talked about this morning about DMV setting up a procedure so that law enforcement, if they stop a vehicle where a person's supposed to have an ignition interlock, they can see that information at the top of the driving record as opposed to buried way at the bottom. So we're hoping that law enforcement will be that will change through DMV, and law enforcement will be trained to better enforce the IID laws because they're not being enforced very much now.
Last follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't going to bring that up until I heard the comment of, I don't remember your numbers, 20 some thousand are required to, and there's 6,000 being used. I would argue that number can in part be attributed to people saying, I'm not going to do it, and I'm going to drive. So I think that number can reflect a couple different points, certainly.
Okay. Anything further? Thank you, panel. Mr. Harker.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney. I am the part-time executive director for the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I come today representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. What I have passed out to you today is my testimony, copies of my testimony for Senate Bill 394, which was heard this morning in this room through Senate Judiciary. And that bill eliminated IIDs or ignition interlock devices for diversions. This bill does not do that, the one you're hearing today, obviously. It restricts the use of IIDs under certain conditions, which counsel has already described, and I won't repeat those here. The Oregon District Attorneys Association is opposed to House Bill 2660, and the reason for that is set out in that memo that I filed. What I want you to, what I want to do, and this is important, I want to cover a little bit of this history. How did we get to where we have diversions? How did we get to where we have ignition interlock devices for diversion? In 2011, the House of Representatives passed House Bill 3075, and it passed unanimously in the House, 60-0, and it passed the Senate 27-0 with three people excused, saying, we're going to do this in Oregon. We're going to have ignition interlock devices on diversion agreements. Everybody virtually voted for it. That was modified in 2013 to say we're going to allow medical exemptions and employer exemptions, very narrow. If you can't medically use an ignition interlock device for some reason, we're not going to require it. And if your employer requires you to drive, we're not going to put it on the employer's car. Okay? And that passed. Oh, and by the way, there was a Dash 2 amendment at that time that would have made it optional for the judge or given the judge discretion, and that amendment did not move out of committee. So that the 2013 amendment was narrowly crafted, medical exemption, employer exemption, and there weren't any objections to it, and it moved right through with the same kind of votes. The House was 59-0 with one excuse, and the Senate was 30 aye votes. So that's the history. And why did the legislature do that? Well, I can tell you what the testimony was because I was there and I testified. And the testimony was that ignition interlocks work. They work to reduce the recidivism of drunk drivers. Now, you heard earlier testimony about that. I'm just going to I wrote it all down for you. It's in that five pages, and you can read that. And what we know is that they stop people from driving drunk, but they allow people to drive if they're sober. And I know some people think they're punitive. What I think is that they're a good check on people and that they help with rehabilitation. That's why we have interlocks. And interlocks on first offenders, by the way, my memo was written in 2011. And so I went back and I updated that memo. And I actually pulled out a chunk of ignition interlock research from February 2014 from the National Highway Traffic Safety folks. And research provides strong evidence that while installed in an offender's vehicle, interlocks reduce recidivism among both first-time and repeat offenders. That's important because that diversion that we have in Oregon, which, by the way, the Oregon District Attorneys Association is a fan of, and I'm personally a fan of that, diverting these people out, not convicting them, those are the first-time offenders. Now, the research estimates that the first time you catch somebody, they've already driven drunk 80 times, okay? So, and that's in the letter that was passed out to you from the Mothers Against Drunk Driving. So the answer is these people, with rare exception, are not first-time offenders. It's the first time they've been caught as an offender. All right? So the research, not to belabor it, because you can read it all in this memo, but one study, a 50% reduction in recidivism while the interlock was installed on the vehicle. Another study, recidivism was reduced by 95% while the interlock was installed on the vehicle. These things work. They allow people to drive. Are they inconvenient? Yes. But they're important to do if we're going to keep intoxicated drivers off the road. Suspension alone doesn't work. We know that. But if they're suspended and then they get their license back and they have an interlock on them so they can drive, it's a perfect world. They get to drive. There is inconvenience, but it keeps them sober while they're driving. Now, the Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, in 2015, they put out a report by state about how you're doing, how we're doing in here in Oregon, and we get 3 stars out of 5. What they say here is Oregon has improved the state's drunk driving law, a mandatory interlock law in 2007, coupled with strong law enforcement efforts, has reduced drunk driving deaths by 30%. Seems good. And in 2011, a loophole was closed to require ignition interlocks in DUI diversion agreements. At that time, as more than half, 11,000 of 24,000 DUI offenders received diversion agreements. People opt into diversion. I've advised people to opt into diversion agreements. Okay, so the last thing I'll tell you about the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, November 2013, pretty recent. Model Guideline for State Ignition Interlock Programs. Their introduction says there is strong scientific evidence from several countries that show alcohol ignition interlocks, while in use, are effective tools to reduce drunk driving among both first and repeat offenders. That's their introduction. So here's parts of their model programs for states to adopt in legislation. They should require ignition interlocks for all individuals convicted of or having their driving privileges suspended for alcohol-impaired driving, including first-time DWI, that's our DUII, offenders as a condition of license reinstatement. The evidence, I'd suggest to you, is overwhelming that we should have individuals use ignition interlock devices. Now, this is me talking versus my clients, the Oregon District Attorney's Association. I had a chance to look at the proposed amendment, and I had a chance to hear this testimony about the individual that Representative Olson brought here about the zero-zero blow, and they were on prescription medications. One, I would suggest that's a rare event. If you want to carve something out for that, you can do that. Let me give you a suggestion. The way you carve that out is you require that individual to go for an alcohol evaluation. We do that all the time now. Okay, that's not a unique event out there in the world. You make sure that they are, at least as best they can do with that evaluation, not a problem drinker. And that hopefully maybe they're not a drinker at all. But you evaluate, they get to pay for that, that's the way it is now. And then the judge has the discretion whether to install it or not, assuming a 0-0 blow. If they don't blow, they're on an ignition interlock. Okay, that's the exception, and that's at least one way around that particular thing. But you're going to have to, you'd have to edit down this Dash 1 amendment substantially to reach that, because it's much broader than that, and it allows for people who are drinking and driving and on diversion agreements to not have an ignition interlock, and the research says that shouldn't happen. I had one other point. there was a question about enforcement, and the simple answer to enforcement is Oregon is weak in enforcement. We have not committed the resources to the Oregon State Police or otherwise to enforce all of the ignition interlocks. We should do that. You got to find the money, do it. That's been the problem in the past, is that it's too expensive. The fiscal kills it. It goes down to ways and means, and it dies. The state of Washington has troopers up there. I went to a conference a few years ago about it. And they have troopers up there assigned to do that enforcement on the ignition interlocks and make sure people are actually using them. So that's all my testimony.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Harkerode?
I do. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so Doug, I greatly appreciate your thoughts on the rare event and your suggestion too for what the offender should do as a requirement. So would an alcohol assessment be the same as an alcohol evaluation?
I don't know the answer to that. Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I don't know the answer to that. We'd have to ask the pros on that as to whether they're similar.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to point out, you know, Doug, that's exactly what Josette read of her daughter's letter, that she did have a drug and alcohol assessment.
Yeah. And Chair Barker, may I just make one? We want to make sure that's from a qualified individual who actually is trained to do those sorts of things. But there are those people. Yeah. And let me just emphasize, that's Doug talking, not the Oregon District Attorney's Association. We didn't run this amendment by anybody except some of the folks here in the room.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2660. And I think we're going to jump down to House Bill 2704 since we have Representative Frederick here to testify. And that's when we open a public hearing on House Bill 2704.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2704 comes to us from Representative Frederick. The bill provides that recording a peace officer or parole and probation officer does not constitute the crime of interfering with a peace officer unless the person doing the recording actually prevents the officer from performing their lawful duties. The bill, as introduced, creates an exemption to ORS 165-540 one-party consent rule in the context of recording an officer if the person is recording the law enforcement officer engaging in lawful duties. The dash one amendments, excuse me, before the committee eliminate the exemption to the one-party consent rule and state that the person must inform the officer that they are doing the recording.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lou Frederick, state representative from District 43, North and Northeast Portland. And I really appreciate you bringing this forward for a hearing and possible work session. I bring a dash two amendment. I hope you were able to get that.
We did get the dash two amendments later.
Thank you. That brings the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs on board supporting the bill. The amendment simply deletes the word actually from two places in the bill. The problem we're trying to solve here is that there have been repeated instances in which officers have demanded that citizens turn off or turn over cameras being used to film interactions between officers and the public. There have even been arrests on the claims of interference of citizens whose only offense was recording from a safe distance a public event, an interaction between a public servant and a member of the public taking place in public. Those arrests do not stand up. Those confiscations do not stand up. But law-abiding citizens have had to deal with the aftermath of arrests and or confiscations that are later thrown out as baseless. Now, as public servants ourselves, we conduct our business in public. We're being recorded and transmitted for all to see right now. The browser histories and email accounts on our state computers are potentially public. It doesn't matter whether we're comfortable with that or not. It's part of the deal as a public servant. By calling this out explicitly in statute, I hope that it would become a training priority to stress that an officer performing his or her duties in public has no justified expectation that his or her actions are private for the purpose of whether they can be recorded. This bill does not change the offense of interfering with an officer. It simply says that recording the officer by itself is not interference. I believe you have written testimony from the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs in support of this bill. And again, the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs has indicated they will support the bill with the adoption of the Dash 2 amendment. There was a Dash 1 amendment posted. I do not know by whom. It would pretty much delete everything meaningful about the bill, and I oppose it. I feel it's important to amend both the statute on the interfering with a peace officer and the statute on obtaining, that is, recording conversations. The bill as introduced clarifies that the recording by itself is not interference, and that it clarifies that recording a law enforcement officer while the officer is performing official duties is not prohibited under the statute that protects private conversations. I urge you to adopt the Dash 2 amendment and send the bill to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Who is that? I'm not
familiar with those. The Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs?
Yeah.
That was a group that we worked with. I believe that, I'm not sure whether Michael's here or not. I guess he's not here right now. But Michael Savaggio and others we were working
with. Okay. Thank you. And this would allow, so what this is saying that we would take away the restriction in Oregon law against recording audio without notification.
Well, there's that. It's also it's really trying to say that you can't just decide that you're interfering just because you're recording, and that's what we've run into. We've had people arrested and cameras and other things taken away just because someone's standing across the street and an officer doesn't like the idea that they're recording what's going on.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Frederick, Representative Greenland?
Thank you. What was the problem with actually? I looked at it.
They wanted to make sure that it was not a particularly clear word as far as they were concerned, and they wanted actually taken away from that. That's all. That's what I understand it.
Okay. Oh, sorry, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, in looking at the text of the bill, so my question is, and thinking back of to times where I worked the road and sometimes arrested people and sometimes didn't arrest people, I can think of those circumstances where I would be called into a home or a whatever and dealing with folks. And my first goal was to keep everybody safe. My next goal was to calm everybody down. And sometimes to calm people down, certain people need to leave the room because they just keep jacking the situation up. And so my concern would be if that's the person holding the camera, It's a little difficult for me to get them or for an officer to get them to leave the room when you're trying to contain things and calm things down. And so my concern is, does that camera kind of change that paradigm a little bit and give that person more latitude and less ability to calm a situation so people don't get hurt?
Thank you, Chair Barker, Representative Springer. I think this speaks to something very simply. They would be interfering with the situation. That's interfering. If they're creating a problem, you're in a small area, and they are clearly creating a problem, creating either high anxiety on the part of what's going on, and you're trying to deal with the issue. That's interfering. Exactly.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, Representative Weininger.
Well, Representative Frederick, I just want to thank you for some really focused and careful work you've done, and you've obviously been working hard to bring together coalitions and craft something that is broadly acceptable to people, you know, all the stakeholders who are involved, and I think it's important, and I think it's a really important contribution to where we are right now in the life of our state and our nation, so thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair,
I'm comment? Sorry, sure.
I'd just like to comment. I think this is very important, and we actually tried to do this, I guess, in 13 session. And some of the issue has to do with the warning that you're taking a picture, but I think we need to figure out how to get this. Everybody, as you notice, carries around a cell phone that can photograph people, and it's just becoming a part of daily life. And I think the notion that recording a police officer while they're in official duties while not interfering with whatever they're doing, just should be legal. And I think the courts typically find this legal. But
the question is the audio recording is the question. You can do the filming.
Theoretically, you can do video recording without.
Right. Correct.
Without notifying.
You can, not theoretically. Yes.
That's no, theoretically, because we heard story after story where people were simply video recording and they were stopped by the police from doing it. I'm sure Representative Frederickson.
There are enough stories there, Representative Greenlick. Absolutely.
Any further? Anything
people ought to stop recording us, too.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Gail Meyer and Kimberly McCullough.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, we'd like to thank Representative Frederick for bringing this bill forward. We definitely support it. We think it's needed. It's necessary to codify this because while you can make a distinction between are people being prosecuted for this, they may not be because the DAs have figured out there's constitutional protections at play here. But people are still being arrested for this. And so we do think it's necessary to have this codified in statute. As to the constitutional rights that are at play here, I'm going to be deferring to my colleague here, Kimberly McCullough, with the ACLU, because she's the one that knows all that. What I can say is that the cases do show, the ones that I'm about to relate to you, I put out a query on our listserv. I said, okay, guys, let me hear the stories on this one. And the stories really consistently were that the person doing the recording was clearly not interfering with the law enforcement conducting their activities. So in one instance, a man was standing on his own lawn using a phone to video officers arresting someone across the street. Officer came over and said, excuse me, but are you recording? And the answer was yes, and they seized the phone and arrested the individual. Now, no charges were filed, but he was arrested. In another instance, a gentleman was recording his own interrogation. So he was in custody. He had been arrested. He was Mirandized. He was being recorded by the police. He had his own phone on recording, and they didn't apparently know it at the time, but he was charged with interfering. Interception, in that he was not charged with it, but he was arrested for it, although two arrests now, double charged. And in another one, a gentleman had a business, and he had video equipment showing to the outside of the business as well as video equipment on the inside of the business. And there was an instance where the officers came into the business and were querying the gentleman about some of his activities, and then they left. The gentleman then took the video of the interior questioning and he put it on YouTube. And then he was arrested for interception. So these arrests that I relate to you are instances where in no instance was the person, the defendant, really doing anything to prevent law enforcement from conducting its activity. They were simply recording what was going on at the time. And while those arrests did not result in prosecution, sometimes they had to be hard fought in order for the cases to go away. Some instances, someone pushed it to trial, turning down offers. One offer came in at 50 days in jail, and they turned it down, and then ultimately the case was dismissed. In another instance, the offer was a violation, and they still turned that down, and ultimately the case was resisted. So the only point I'm trying to make is that not having this codified in statute does expose people to arrests when clearly when the lawyers take a look at it, they realize there's constitutional rights at play here, and there really isn't any interfering. And so it's based on that that we would submit that codifying this in law is an important next step. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee,
We're in support of the dash two.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm very excited, actually, to talk to you about this subject as it's near and dear to my heart. I've been studying this particular area of law for a number of years now, and this is my very first time giving testimony at a legislative hearing.
For the record.
Oh, Kimberly McCullough with the ACLU. I'm sorry. So what I'd like to talk to you about is some specifics that relate to this bill. We're in favor of the bill. We are against the Dash 1 amendments and in support of the Dash 2 amendments. The problem here is that there's a gray area in Oregon law related to the right to record on-duty police officers, and that gray area is inconsistent with constitutional law. That's coupled with the fact that there is a huge problem that's actually around our nation with police officers interfering with the right to record. Now, there are a lot of officers who don't do that, but the problem is that there are also many officers who do. This is contrary to a general consensus about the constitutional law on this issue. Courts across the nation, whether they be state Supreme Courts, courts of appeal, district courts, circuit courts of appeal, all consistently have held that there is a right to record officers when they're engaged in their public duties. That is also the consensus among a number of other parties, including the Federal Department of Justice, who have I cited to some guidance that they've provided on this issue, as well as the International Chiefs of Association of Chiefs of Police. So this is not really actually like very much of a controversial issue in regards to whether or not it's constitutional. But despite that consensus and despite litigation, the problem persists. And I have had the opportunity to work with a gentleman, Mickey Ostreicher, with the National Press Photographers Association, and he actually travels around the country training police departments on this issue and working very closely with them. And what he's found is that when there is adequate training and policies in place, things improve. And so what Representative Frederick said about this being a clear message that he hopes will spark clearer policies and training, I think that that is really essential, and that's why the legislature doing something about this will really make a difference. This particular bill does a number of things that I think are particularly important. One is that it treats different methods of expression the same. The First Amendment doesn't distinguish between pens and pencils and paintbrushes and cameras and video cameras. They're all treated the same under the First Amendment. And so this is very important that it doesn't distinguish between those. It also clarifies that the mere act of recording, which is a passive act, it doesn't actually do anything to the person that's being recorded, that mere act in and of itself is not interference. And Representative Fredericks addressed this point of that interference in some other regard is still going to be criminalized under the statute for interfering. For example, officers, it's generally accepted that officers need a zone of safety around themselves. So a person standing outside of that zone of safety with a camera is not interfering by merely recording, but it's if they enter into that zone of safety, it's still not the act of recording that's doing something. It's the fact that they entered in. And so this statute or this bill very carefully distinguishes between those situations and still allows for officers to prevent actual interference. I just use the word actually. I think the reason that I use that word is like the Department of Justice has used that word in their guidance. I don't think that it's necessary to have it into the statute, and that's why I think if removing it will help this bill move forward, that's why we support that. The other thing that this statute does is it clarifies our wiretapping statute in a way that brings it into line with the Constitution. Notice requirements are particularly problematic, and I'd like to give you two scenarios to help demonstrate that. The first I want you to think about is the Rodney King incident, which we can all, I'm sure, remember. Imagine that you're witnessing the Rodney King incident and you're standing about 15 feet away and you have a camera and you want to record it. What a notice requirement does is it forces you to say something to those officers while they're engaged in a use of force in order to draw attention to yourself before you hit the record button. That's a dangerous situation for that individual. And in fact, we know that when individuals do that, it sometimes triggers police officers to then approach that person. Second scenario is somewhat different. That's where the officer is may be engaged in a dangerous or a complicated situation, in order to record that person without and avoid criminal liability, you now have to interrupt them. You have to draw their attention from the thing that they're doing. And if you don't do that, you're risking getting charged. So you're basically between a rock and a hard place. You have to either interfere or not say anything. So you're going to get charged under one statute or the other. Or you could not record. And that chills speech. And that's not constitutional. So that's why we don't like the notice requirement. That's why the Dash 1 amendment that puts the notice requirement back in is problematic. But I recognize that, and let me back up just a second. Part of the reason that this came to our attention is because the ACLU launched an app phone application called Mobile Justice. And the idea is that people can download that application and have it on their phone. They can record a police encounter and it automatically uploads it to the ACLU. I was working as a cooperating attorney with the ACLU at the time that that was developed, and they contacted me, and my advice was, don't include audio, because it's not clear under Oregon law, and you don't want to put your members and the people using this application in danger under Oregon law right now, because they're going to end up potentially in a situation. Now, I think if they litigated that, you know, they could succeed, but as Gail was saying, they're still getting arrested, right? They're still having to go through that situation, and we don't want to put our members in that situation. I'd like to say one other thing, which is that I understand that there are concerns with surreptitious recording of police officers, and I think that there are basically sort of two scenarios that I've heard about that. One is surreptitious recording in furtherance of a crime, right, maybe trying to find out information. The other is surreptitious recording that has to do with maybe a domestic violence victim or something like that. And what I'd like to say is that the wiretapping statute is not the appropriate vehicle for dealing with those situations, and those situations are already dealt with in under other areas of law. In regards to the surreptitious recording in furtherance of a crime, if you're doing that, that's part of your attempt to commit a crime, right? So you already have a criminal enterprise, and that criminal enterprise is already going to be illegal, right? If it has to do with the victim and somebody else who has some sort of serious privacy interest at stake, that person would still have a private right of action for invasion of privacy. If that video was published and it revealed something particularly sensitive about that person. So again, the wiretapping statute is not necessarily the best vehicle for addressing that, in particular because if we use the wiretapping statute and we require this notice requirement, we're capturing, it's very over-inclusive, it's capturing all of this constitutionally protected activity. So that's basically what I've got to say. If you guys have any questions, I encourage you to ask, and thank you. We urge your support.
And pardon me, I don't have much of a voice left today. I think on overall, from everything I've heard, everything sounds fine here. This is purely for my benefit. I'm, as one who's been in the public eye for a long, long time, mm-hmm. before this public eye, a different kind of public eye. I worked with a lot of what I would call citizen journalists. Mm-hmm. And what I want to get to is, at what point is our privacy private? Even though these are citizen journalists, they're friends of mine, mm-hmm. it always bothered me a little bit that they were shoving that camera everywhere they could to get their story. And I get that. Mm-hmm. When is my privacy private? And this is just for my use, and I'm concerned a little bit about the officers. I'm concerned a little bit about everybody. When is our privacy private? If I go down the hallway, and we're on camera now, but if I go down the hallway here and have a discussion with Representative Olson and a citizen journalist or whomever comes over and just decides to start recording us, mm-hmm. do they have that right by the Constitution? And can I say, stop, please? And, I mean, this is just a private conversation. Do you see where I'm going? I'm a little afraid that with this whole world of, sorry, these things, please wipe that off when you're done, I'm sick. these things are invading our lives and changing everything, and maybe I'm just a little hesitant.
Yeah, I mean.
Big question. It probably didn't even have a question mark on it.
A little bit off topic, but yeah.
It's not about police reporting.
I know.
And right.
It's a bigger, broader, you understand?
Yeah. I think that's where, I mean, the ACLU is very concerned with individual privacy as well, obviously. That's one of our huge priorities. And so I think there's always a balance to be struck with our laws and how we apply them. In this particular instance, because this has to do with such an important issue, which is, police officers and what's happening with them. In this context, this is something that the Supreme Court and circuit courts have held that what happens with police officers is it's different than everything else. So that conversation you're talking about, I think, is an important conversation. I think that it's uncomfortable that we're always on video, but specifically with regards to police officers, I think that that's a situation where we it's just the unfortunate reality. I know that makes police officers uncomfortable as well, but this is really important for accountability. It's important for everybody to know what's going on. Honestly, chiefs of police, a lot of them really like this because they know what's going on with their officers. And it really helps engender a feeling of trust in the system for the public when they know that they have this right. So I think in this context, it's just important that, that we do this.
Okay. This will be specific. Thank you, Chairman Barker. I'm also just a smidge concerned about provocation. Mm-hmm. I've watched, again, because mm-hmm. of my experience with citizen journalists, and I love these guys, mm-hmm. but they kind of sometimes like to just mm-hmm. a little bit, dig, mm-hmm. and try to make a story. Mm-hmm. When is the police officer protected in this case? Because now there might not even be a crime or anything going on, but just, hey, Officer Jones, can I video you for a while and make sure you're doing the right thing? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do see what you're saying, and I think that there are certainly circumstances where those additional actions above and beyond the simple act of recording could certainly interfere. For example, if you're just like following this police officer everywhere they go all day, every day, and talking to them and trying to provoke them, like certainly that's interfering with their duties, right?
I want to catch you in the act of something.
I'm not
Gail,
sure
do you want to say something?
Yeah, if somebody just follows you around taking pictures.
If they're like right in your space and they're talking to you all the time, I mean, I've seen Supreme Court cases where a person got charged with interfering with a police officer for continuously and constantly badgering the officer and interrupting them, and that was upheld. So
I watch videos on YouTube. Mm-hmm.
But there's a certain amount of criticism and difficulty that police officers just have to deal with as part of the job. And that is also protected by the Constitution. So, again, there's a balance there. If the person is really actually doing a bunch of stuff over and over again that interferes, then you're crossing the line. Go ahead, Gail.
Chair Barker, if I might make a comment there, and actually, Representative Springer, kind of relates to the query you were making about what do you do when the person with the phone is really the one that's sort of, I won't use the word interfering because that's...
I think I used the term jacking up the situation.
Thank you, that. I think it all comes down to what's currently in the statute, line 12, refuses to obey a lawful order by the peace officer. And that's the issue. I think you'd come in, if an officer were to say, buddy, you are jacking up this situation, I need you to step out the house or go back 15 feet or be quiet or whatever, mm-hmm. then they refuse to comply, I think it would be legitimate to say an officer could arrest that person for interfering, and then the issue would be in a court of law, was that a lawful order?
Right.
Or were you, because what people have, what has occurred in other situations is the officer saying, put that phone down, and the person says no, mm-hmm. and then they arrest them. Mm-hmm. Is that a lawful order? And if the mere act is simply recording, the courts have concluded no, unless there's some other aspect of what you're doing that is the problem. Mm-hmm. So does that make sense?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that, Gail. So I don't have a concern about cops being caught doing bad stuff. I've worked with a ton of cops over the years, and I can count on a hand, and their faces are coming to me, the bad cops, and nobody wanted them around less than the good cops.
But also I'm talking about, let's pick the part of the video that's most exciting, not the video that creates context of a situation. And when I look at that, I think of, okay, so who have I interviewed? Who have I dealt with? What have I done? So what about the kid? I mean, a kid in school has to, parents have to sign a waiver. I've done it for a bunch of years now. You could print my kid's picture. But yet a kid is in that situation, part of the video, and there goes YouTube, and it's done. What about the kids in this situation? What about the victims that don't want the whole world to know they just got thumped or whatever? What about their rights?
Chair Barker, Representative Springer, I think there was a I'm trying to answer that. There was a scenario posed of suppose in an apartment hallway, an officer is responding to a concern of domestic violence occurring on the other side of a door. They call the victim out, and somebody else comes along, starts to record, and they're not interfering, but the officer feels that there's a privacy issue at stake here with respect to the interview. I think I would analyze it this way. If the act of recording can actually impede the ability of the officer to do their work, that could be considered to be interfering. If the mere act of standing there and recording and being in the face chills a victim or a witness or something from coming forward and making disclosures, and the officer's ability to actually investigate, then I think you're in a different scenario than the person who's simply standing across the street videoing an officer as they're making an arrest.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Thank you. And I think you described something different there. And really what this clearly looks like to me is the kid in school has a level of protection for their picture being used in media. But a kid on the street, when there's a cop present, loses that right. Mm. They just do. If there's a kid around there, if a kid comes out the door or whatever, they're on video now. And so they, in their own atmosphere, they've lost rights that they have a right to expect at school. That doesn't sound quite right to me.
Chair Barker and Representative Springer, I don't know that anyone, though, really is entitled to a sense that their photographic image is protected once they're out on the streets.
Okay.
Chair Barker.
I'm also assuming that you're not asking to lift the notification for everybody recording, so that you're not saying we just want to do it so that I can surreptitiously record you and or somebody else, right? You're not asking for that. And then one other, I mean, I don't want to go in too many scenarios because it's like pretty soon it'll get too ridiculous, but one concern I might have is if I'm the cop and you're a victim of maybe domestic violence, and I have you at the door and we're talking in the hallway and somebody comes down and starts filming it, and I don't care. I mean, they're filming me, I'm working, that's fine. But you say, I don't want that guy taking that picture. Then I'm not sure where we go from there. Where the right, or, I mean, but I don't want to keep doing these one at a time. But.
Thank you. Chair Barker, I would agree with you. I do think it comes down to the issue in B, whether or not the officer gives a lawful order for something to stop happening that is otherwise preventing that officer from engaging in their investigation.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, Representative Post.
Terberg, I want to follow up then on what you've said, just because even the scenario doesn't really matter. From what I'm just hearing you say, Gail, and from what Chair Barker just said, so it, really we're giving the discretion to the police officer. Are we not?
Chair Barker and Representative Post, the officer has currently got the right to say, I'm going to give you an order, stop doing what you're doing. The question becomes in a court of law, is that a lawful order or not? And I hope I'm answering your question. So it's not totally in the officer's discretion, no, because the question then becomes on review in a court of law, is that a lawful order? Or were they asked, or are they ordering you to do something they didn't have the authority to tell you to do? And so people have been arrested before, and actually in prior years prosecuted for simply recording. Mm-hmm. And the officers would say, stop recording. And the person would say no. And then they would get arrested. And then the question becomes in the courtroom, was that a lawful order? Could you lawfully tell that person to stop videoing you? And this is where the First Amendment issues come into play. So it's not a complete discretion in the officer, because there's review in the courtroom about whether or not the order was lawful.
Then what are we fixing here? Because it in a court of, so what you're saying is the officer says stop the camera, mm-hmm. and then in the court of law they decide whether that was a lawful order or not.
Chair Barker, Representative Post, what we're saying in subsection C and in 4 is the act of recording of itself is not a crime.
And Representative, what changes here is the audio portion. You can film yeah. now. You can take the video, but mm-hmm. the audio piece is that part of Oregon law that there's the conflict mm-hmm. right now. And we yes.
And so that's my question, Mr. Chair. I thought I understood this earlier, and then I thought, well, no, I was wrong, and now I'm back to I'm not sure where I'm at. So I get that we've always been able to take pictures and video. It's about the sound. Mm-hmm. And this law changes it and says that basically police officers in their capacity no longer have that right.
Yep. Dash one says they still do. So.
Okay.
Yeah. We're not.
But what about the people around them? What about their rights? People around the cops?
That's a whole different ballgame. Yeah. Yeah,
I'm a little confused about how we deal with them.
Representative Springer and Chair Barker, I think I could add some clarity here. In all of the court cases around the country that deal with this issue, it's the presence of a police officer and the fact that the police officer is being recorded that triggers the right to record. So granted, there may be somebody else standing there that you couldn't have recorded audio of without notice if the police officer was not present, but the presence of the police officer then triggers that constitutional right. I understand the concerns about children being present or a domestic violence victim being present, and the fact that it may then take the officer making the decision to go into that person's house with them and close the door or take that person to somewhere else. But that situation is already happening even if there's no camera. I mean, when the person walks up in the hallway to watch what happens with the domestic violence victim and the officer, there's still a person there watching it. They could write an article about it the next day and post it all over the internet. If there was a kid that got arrested, for example, they could do the same thing. They could take that kid's picture and write a story about it. So those are certainly concerns. It's not a fortunate thing when those kinds of things happen. But as I mentioned before, if it was a very, very sensitive issue, that person may be able to have some sort of civil liability under an invasion of privacy statute themselves against that person if it had to do with something very, very sensitive. So I don't know that this statute really, or that this bill, it's consistent with what's constitutional.
They could already film it without the sound.
And they could already film without the sound. They could already have their picture.
And
yeah.
we're not going to be able to move this bill today, and we do have some other bills. Is there any further questions? So just remarks. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'll call Chris Hoy, Jeff Howes, and Kevin Campbell.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I am here, I know it's a little bit confusing, to speak in opposition to House Bill 2704. First things first, Representative Greenlick, happy birthday. Second, there is a new organization. It's a recently formed union organization of police groups called the Oregon, I can't remember, Police and Sheriffs. So that's confusing sometimes. That's not the same as the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and it's not the same as the Oregon State Sheriffs Association. I'm here to speak on behalf of both the Chiefs and Sheriffs Associations in opposition to the bill. I think there's two sections of the bill that are important. I don't want to mix the two because I want to acknowledge that there are some meaningful pieces of the bill, and then there's some pieces that are very troubling to us as well. I do want to mention in this first section, Look, police officers are very aware they're being recorded now. It is not a surprise to police officers that their interactions are being recorded. And I will say, in statute today, I don't believe that recording, audio recording of an event or recording of an event constitutes interfering. There has to be something different in order for it to rise to the level of actually interfering. I don't believe that it is policy now, and should not be policy now, for an officer to order someone to stop recording as a lawful order. I think there are other lawful orders that an officer uses in order to make sure that somebody that's getting too close to the scene represents a distraction that could represent danger either to the officer or victims or other participants in an encounter. The officer today can say, I'm sorry, sir, you're going to have to step back right now. You're creating a safety issue. Doesn't have anything to do with the recording of the event. And I think that the wording here does put a fine point on the idea that that it does not constitute interfering on its face. I do, and we did identify in our testimony, we did have problems with bringing in language that, albeit it could be used in some federal setting, is not common in our case law, and that was the word actually. So we didn't like those that wording, and so I appreciate at least that part of the dash too. But let me go to the part of the bill that I think is particularly troubling, because in my mind, you could pass just this portion on interfering and accomplish some clarity and get to the point which I think has drawn Representative Frederick in particular to bring this bill. He doesn't want people to be arrested for interfering when all they are doing is recording, and we get that. And I would say that officers understand that today. The second portion is more troubling, but I do want to mention one other thing, and that is that commonly I am reminded of policies that have been issued by the International Association of Chiefs of Police as a reason for why we should support this, and that our chiefs really like this because they'll know what's going on with their officers. And the truth is, our police chiefs and sheriffs want to know what's going on with their officers, but this is not in keeping with what we mean when we say that. And I would also say that the International Chiefs Association Chiefs of Police are often used because of their model policies to justify language in bills that is very prescriptive about what law enforcement agencies should do, and yet nobody ever mentions the disclaimer. These are done and are often applicable mainly to large agencies. A small agency for the International Association of Chiefs of Police is 50 police officers. A majority of our agencies in the state are small, and yet the aspirational policies that are often created by the International Association of Chiefs of Police really fit well with a large agency with a lot amount of resources. So I just mentioned that as a side. The piece that's perhaps most troubling is not the incident where the person is recording a police interaction within range. And it is a situation where conversations can be obtained from a distance. And what we don't think about, which is very available today, is the kind of technology that allows you to record somebody from a distance and without them even knowing you're there in ways that I would describe as surreptitious. And so the second page of the bill on line 34 is very problematic. It has far more implications than people have indicated so far today. It goes beyond the simple recording within range of somebody to something that could be very surreptitious. This could involve any number of officers doing any kind of work, including undercover work. It could include conversations, as we've already noted, with people that are in very vulnerable spots. If this passes, their ability to receive notice is gone as well. And while I do believe there is some case law regarding the rights of citizens to record, I don't think it goes to the extent that has been described already. So just to be as productive as possible, we would not mind the first portion of the bill, provided the words actually are taken out. We can't live with the second part of the bill on the second page. And so with that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the time today. I know it's been a full afternoon already, and I'll turn it over to my colleagues. Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Jeff Howes. I'm the first assistant to District Attorney Rod Underhill in Multnomah County. And I just have a couple of brief things to say. I didn't sign up for, nor did I sign up against, but in going over this bill, I saw some things that may be problematic. I wanted to bring them to your attention. A lot of those things have already been brought up by the learned members of this committee who saw some of the same issues that I saw. In particular, the voice of the victim of a crime. I think under this bill would be scooped up into a huge dragnet of information gathering that could very possibly do damage to public safety and to law enforcement in general. And we've talked about the scenario where a victim of crime may be interviewed in his or her worst possible moment, frantic, hysterical, and a police officer may need to talk with that victim, quite frankly, about what has just happened, about where the perpetrator is, and may need to then take steps to apprehend that person if necessary. A video recording, audio recording of that could have a devastating, chilling effect on the ability to gather that information, to the point where the person that was just traumatized by some criminal act may say, I can't continue. I cannot speak further because I know that I'm being audio and video recorded. It's astounding to me that there's a suggestion that a victim of a crime, in speaking to a police officer and reporting that crime, may give up his or her right to speak privately to that officer, and the suggestion that, well, the officer can take that person somewhere. Well, taking someone somewhere is an arrest, unless the person agrees to go somewhere with that police officer. And I would submit to this committee that sometimes the victim of a violent crime is in no position to acquiesce to any sort of request to be taken somewhere. There's also the suggestion that doing so may give rise to a private cause of action. So that means that the victim of the crime, having been victimized criminally, now can turn around and sue somebody if they feel that their privacy has been violated. Well, that may be, but it's hardly, I think, the intention of this bill. If we're going to say that a victim of a crime gives up their rights to privacy because they're speaking with a police officer about that crime, I think that's a real problem, and I would suggest that that needs very careful consideration. I reviewed the Dash 1, and I think that it's quite workable. I think that that allows for the victim of the crime and the peace officer and witnesses and whomever else to be on notice, and I think that that's fair, a fair middle ground here. Now, I had a nice conversation with Representative Frederick in January about this and other bills, and I voiced these concerns to him also, that the victims of crime, I think, are not just unrepresented in this scenario, but completely left out. The suggestion that if a person filming, if their act may impede an investigation, that may be interfering. Well, that's just simply not the way the law is now. Impeding is not interfering because the law currently says that interfering is preventing or attempting to prevent someone from doing their lawful duties. I understand very much the reason why this bill has come forward, and I don't think it would be a surprise to anyone in this room to say that my office doesn't prosecute people for filming officers out on the street. But when we're talking about the sound of a victim's voice, I think we have to proceed with caution. Thank you very much for your time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Chris Hoy. I'm the Community Corrections Director in Clackamas County, and I'm the president of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, and I'm speaking on their behalf today. We are opposed to House Bill 2704 as it's written, and I'm going to narrow my remarks just to as it relates to parole and probation, community corrections. I'm not speaking to any of the other scenarios that I've kind of been focused on so far today. The way we read this bill, it would allow our clients to surreptitiously record office visits, home visits, other interactions, And we think that that would have a significant negative impact on our ability to do our job. We're dealing with primarily convicted felons who are steeped in a lot of antisocial, pro-criminal attitudes and beliefs. And our job is to address those issues and try to turn them, help them become pro-social members of our community. We see that a surreptitious recording could lead to triangulation, which our clients, frankly, are quite good at. We have had clients do all sorts of things. Just in my office alone, I've had a client take portions of letters and redact pieces of them and make copies and suggest that we're supporting their release from prison based on some completely unrelated letter that we've sent to them. We've had people use all sorts of different ways to sort of manipulate the system and try to triangulate. And when we say triangulate, it's use pieces of the system against one another. We're often dealing with victim issues where we're having to confront our clients on victim contact, and whether it's a sex offender or a domestic violence offender. And to have those conversations recorded, we think would be quite damaging and actually quite harmful to the victim. And the suggestion earlier by one of the other witnesses that you could bring a private cause of action, just simply, that's great in an academic theoretical sense, but in the practical world where you have a crime victim who's fearful for his or her life, when we're talking to the offender about something the victim has told us or information we have obtained about contact with the victim, a third party action just doesn't resolve anything. We are very concerned that this will actually inhibit our ability to be effective in our jobs, and so we oppose House Bill 2704. Thank you.
Are there any questions in this panel? Representative Krieger.
Not maybe a question, but I had written down here some time ago before you ever got up here about crime scenes, accident scenes, where an officer is having conversation. It could be with a victim, it could be with an offender, it could be with any person, witness. And when they see someone recording, that, like you said, would chill, because they don't want to be out in the public yet, what they said. They're under a great amount of stress. I think they'd have a tendency to really chill that conversation to where the work that needs to be done in that investigation is going to be much more difficult to get done.
Thank you. Yeah. Representative Weininger.
Thank you. Thank you all for testifying, and I know that you care a lot about the work that you undertake, and I know Mr. Hoy personally, and you do a great job at your job. And I just want to note, because I see the Representative Frederick is in the room again, that Mr. Campbell identified modifications that would help you feel comfortable with the bill and still enable a portion of the bill to go forward. So, my feeling, and I appreciate you're doing that, because I think everybody in this room probably agrees that we're at a really unique time in the life of our country and in the perception by some communities and some people in our state and in our country about their safety and the fairness with which they may be treated. And more sunlight, more information probably helps everybody. It probably wards off false accusations of mistreatment, and it helps avoid violence or harm going in both directions when everyone knows that there's more accountability. And so I know that there are body camera bills that people are trying to work together to find a path forward on. And I think I just feel like we need to send a message, all of us, in a united way, that we are open to increased transparency, because we all need there to be trust between the public and public safety. And I see you folks as really wanting that, but I hope very much that we can find a version of this bill that we can pass, because I think it's really important, and now's the time.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2704. Let's see. So we have a couple of minutes to go here. We'll open a hearing, jump down one more to 2609, public hearing on House Bill.
We're going to do 2357.
We're not able to move that today.
We might let everybody know.
Okay. We're not going to be able to move that bill today.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2609 comes to us from Representative Barker and Senator Pozanski. The bill was heard before this committee on February 19th, 2015, and at that time we were waiting for paperwork. That paperwork has arrived, and we're ready to move it today. By way of reminder, the bill provides that an information or complaint shall be deemed verified if the complainant certifies sufficient ground to believe the defendant committed an offense. The bill additionally states that false certification is a Class A misdemeanor. You'll remember this bill was in response to a problem experienced by the Beaverton Municipal Court when attempting to file such documents electronically. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay. I think that is a good enough refresher. I'm going to close the public hearing and go to a work session on House Bill 2609. Is there any questions, any discussion? Are there any objections?
Do you need a motion?
Yeah, you need a motion. Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2609 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Olson moves 2609 to the floor with a due pass. Now, is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered, and I'll carry the bill.
Pretty anxious to move your own bill there, Mr. Chair.
How can anybody object? I don't know. We need to have a hearing. I just
think it'll go on. Gavel's been silent all day.
That's right. Wait a minute. I object.
Too late.
Birthday.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2385. I'm sorry, a work session on House Bill 2385.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2385 clarifies that a person commits the crime of luring a minor if the victim is a police officer posing as a minor. We've also previously heard this bill. The proposed Dash 3 amendments before the committee today clarify that the bill applies to a police officer or the police officer's agent, and it also applies the language to the crime of purchasing sex with a minor. The bill is ready to move today.
Okay, thank you. Colleagues, you'll remember this bill, the amendment we put in there so I can say a police agent, because sometimes it isn't actually a sworn officer who is pretending on the computer to be the minor.
So we have not moved the Dash 3 yet.
To move the Dash 3.
Okay.
We are in work session.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2385.
Representative Olson moves the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2305. Is there any discussion?
2385.
I'm sorry, 2385. Thank you, Representative. Are there any objections? Hearing none, the Dash 3 is removed from the bill.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2385 as amended to the House floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2385 with the Dash 3 amendments to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Barton, would you carry that for us?
Be happy to, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Let's see, jump back up to House Bill 2423, open a public hearing.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2423 comes to us from the Governor's Office for the Department of Corrections. The bill provides that the Department of Corrections inmates serving life sentences for certain crimes are not eligible for earned time reduction in a prison sentence. Additionally, the bill eliminates certain earned time reductions available to inmates of the Department of Corrections for completion of education credentials. And we are still waiting on paperwork for House Bill 2423.
Heidi Stewart, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Heidi Stewart. I'm the Assistant Director of the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Unit with the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to testify today in favor of House Bill 2423. I'll keep this brief. As described, this bill eliminates earned time credit for those serving a life sentence for murder and aggravated murder. It allows the parole board to set the release date without the confusion of having to add in earned time credit. It also eliminates the 60 days earned time credit for those completing education credentials. This additional 60 days was part of legislation that was passed in 2008. The intent of the legislation was to provide an incentive to these individuals to participate in education programs. However, we have not seen an increase in education completions since the passage of that bill. In addition, it's redundant. These individuals already receive earned time credit every 6 months. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions on this one? Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Her paperwork's not ready, so we won't be able to work it today. Close the public hearing, House Bill 2324, and I'm announcing that we're carrying over House Bill 2357 is wasn't ready to work out. Any further business to come before the committee? Stand adjourned. Further business to come before the committee? Stand adjourned.